This episode is brought to you in partnership with Wacom. Across the globe, learning is still handwriting-centric, especially in mathematics and science. This can make the shift to digital tasks challenging. Many schools are seeking effective apps and hardware to ensure a smoother transition for digital learning, especially for STEM lessons.
Expanding digital pen and ink technology from teachers to students opens up new possibilities for communication and collaboration in and out of the classroom. Using pen-enabled devices, teachers and students can explain complex concepts, take notes, provide feedback, and show their work quickly and easily.
Wacom pen displays and tablets easily plug in to the existing IT equipment in the classroom, enabling members of the class to interact with the digital content being shared. The teacher never even needs to turn their back on the class. Collaboration is simple when working on shared documents and apps with the digital pen. There's no new software to learn. You just work with the pen on the screen or tablet instead of the mouse and keyboard on your computer.
As educators, myself, Steve and Ben have all integrated the use of Wacom technology into where we've worked in education, into colleges and schools, and we have seen the benefits for ourselves. So go check it out for yourself. The link is in the show notes for this episode.
One, two.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Edgy Futurist podcast. This is episode 199, if we're following it as we should be doing. Getting up to that big number, and it's, as we're recording today, it is early in December. It's cold, but we did open advent calendars today, so that's a bit of a clue from when we're recording. So yeah, exciting times leading up to Christmas. I know everybody's on countdown now, so... thanks for joining us for another episode of the podcast. Lads, how are we? Are we all right?
All good, yeah. Thanks for rubbing that in. I don't have an advent calendar this year.
Do you know, I've got a snuffling pig one. So it's pork scratchings, different flavours of pork scratchings every day. Yep.
That is absolutely disgusting. No,
it's not horrific. Like,
did you get them from market or what?
No, I love pork scratchings. And they actually, wherever we were, Amanda said, do you want one of these advent calendars? I was like, yeah. Last year, she got one, like, really expensive one with, like, perfume and stuff in it. So
You've got a pig's hoof and ear.
I want a proper one. Yeah.
So. That's because I think, well, we know that the majority of our audience are in the United States. Will they know what a pork scratching is?
I don't know. Maybe. If you don't know what a pork scratching is, you are missing out. It's an absolute taste sensation, and
haven't tasted much in your life, yeah.
No, you've got to love a pork scratching.
I got a spam one. Yeah, I got a spam calendar advent calendar this year.
You're such an idiot.
What do you mean? I got a spam one. I did. It's like a load of variation, like luncheon meat, spam.
Spam for now.
Yeah, I got loads of different variations of horrific meat. That doesn't go out, if you put it out in the open, just doesn't go off for 5 years, like a pork scratching.
Pork scratching is a staple. When you're having a pint of John Smith's, a pint of Smooth, it's really good in a pub, a packet of pork scratching.
We're not doing much for the old northerner stereotypes.
Yeah, as Ben,
Smooth in a pork scratching.
How's the whipping going, Ben? Is it all right?
Yeah, very good. Very good. To be honest, there's only one of us that wears a flat cap of the three of us. So let's call a spade a spade.
I don't wear a flat cap.
No. Dan loves a flat cap, don't you, Dan?
Do you know what? I just rooted it out the other day. I was like, now it's getting the winter.
I thought you were starring in New Oliver Twist in your local Amdram. What are you on about? You're not wearing that for real, are you?
No, he wants to be in Peaky Blinders. That's what he is. He's watched Peaky Blinders and he thought I'm gonna wear myself a flat cap.
Well, speaking of December, I ain't got a spam advent calendar. My wife got me a lovely mug from the Elf about a cotton-headed Ninny Muggins, which I absolutely love. But tomorrow I'm taking the kids to see Santa.
Yes.
So I'm off tomorrow, and that's the first one. Polar Express in a couple of weeks, but yeah, going to see Santa tomorrow. So it's definitely December.
Definitely, it is. And there is a conversation now, lads. This is an interesting thing that they've shortened the odds of the likelihood of a white Christmas in the UK. So they've shortened the odds, and it was 2-1, and now it's 4-5 on. So nice. That looks like it could be a white Christmas. And apparently the definition of a white Christmas, it must snow on Christmas Day. It's not, you can have snow on the ground. It must actually snow for it to be officially classed as a white Christmas.
One flake. Of it being a white Christmas where our guest is today. I imagine he gets, you get some good odds for that.
Yeah, very, very, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. Should we bring him in?
Yes, we do. Yeah, so we're really delighted today to be joined by Gavin McCormack, all the way from. I was gonna try and do an Australian accent, but I'm probably worse at it than anybody else.
All the way from the future. He's literally in tomorrow right now.
He's in tomorrow. I love it. He said good morning when he came on. Gavin, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Yes, I'm coming from Australia in the future, where I've actually opened my advent calendar yesterday. And I've got a soft cheese advent calendar, actually.
What is going on with advent calendars?
Yeah, and it's 40 degrees here, so you can imagine how disgusting it is after a couple of weeks.
Yes, 40 degrees. Like that is epic. One of my best pals lives in Auckland, and he's always talking about how exciting it is to have Christmas on the beach. I'm like, no, I'm not entirely sure whether I agree with that. I think it's got to be cold at Christmas. But if you've been used to having Christmas on the beach, then it's wicked. So yeah. So Gavin, you're joining us. Whereabouts in Australia are you joining us from tonight?
I'm from Sydney. Yeah.
Okay, so you have that isn't a Sydney accent though, is it? So I wonder if you could give us a little bit of a background to you and how you ended up out in Australia.
Okay, well, firstly, thanks for having me. Appreciate being here. Nice banter. It's nice to see a bit of banter in a podcast at the beginning. For three likely lads. So I was born in England, Northern England. I grew up in Yorkshire. Went to university at Sheffield Hallam University. Nearly failed my degree, actually. My tutor gave me a very stern warning after the first year of my university degree and said, look, this is not a party. You better actually do some assignments. Otherwise, we're going to boot you. And so I got my head down and did my degree, got my teaching degree, worked in Sheffield for a few years, and moved to France. Used to work in France over in a place called Vendôme, which is just south of Paris. And then I was always addicted to traveling. So I just went on this gallivanting trip around the world using my teaching degree. Went to Spain, zoomed over to China, ended up in Japan, South Korea, landed in Australia, where I worked in an Islamic school for 10 years, which was pretty cool, really cool, working with refugees from Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, and then did a Montessori degree, became a Montessori teacher, then became a Montessori principal, and here we are.
So Montessori degree, I didn't realize you could do a degree in that. Is that like a full 3-year program? How does that work?
It's actually a diploma, but it's a three and a half year program. Yeah.
Wow. Nice. So what is I think that the whole Montessori side of education, a lot of people might not be familiar with it, especially in the UK. So can you just give us a bit of an insight into what all that's about?
Yeah, of course. Look, it's and I must get that question all the time. I'm actually the Montessori ambassador from Montessori Australia. So I get this all the time. What is Montessori? And there's a misconception. And I was actually part of the misconception too. At the very beginning, I didn't know what Montessori was either. So I was always asking that question of what actually is it? So we all went to a school, and the school was a standard school, I'm guessing, just a normal, regular, mainstream school. The way that a normal mainstream school works in general is the teacher's at the front and says, this week we're going to be learning about volcanoes. I know everything you need to know. I look at the screen, write down the diagram, open the book, read the words, copy them down, answer the questions, color in your diagram, stick it in the returns tray. I'll mark it. Well done. You know everything about volcanoes. We'll do a little quiz or a test and we're all good. We all went to a school very similar to that. And that's happening in 99% of schools in the world now. Montessori does something very different. Starts off the lesson by saying, hey, guys, we're going to learn about volcanoes, but I don't know everything about volcanoes because I'm just a human being like you. But I do know some really inspirational stuff. Let me get you totally hooked from the very outset. So the teacher gets the children hooked. And that could be something very tactile, something you touch, see, feel, you know, listen to, taste. It depends on what you're teaching. But after 10 minutes, the teacher then says, now you're inspired. what else do you want to know about volcanoes? And every hand in the class goes up, and the kids say, how hot is lava? What happens when a super volcano erupts? Did a volcano really wipe out the dinosaurs? What happened in 532 AD when there was a blackout in the northern hemisphere for two years and there was mass poverty? So you write all these questions down. You say, these are amazing questions, guys. I don't know the answers. I'm sorry, because I'm just a human being. But the answers are in this room. There's an iPad. There's the library. The principal's down the hall. You can go to another class. You can make a phone call. You can send an email, whatever you want. But on Friday, we're meeting on the carpet, and you're going to tell us everything that you now know about volcanoes. You can work with whom you want. You can sit where you wish. You can represent your research in any way you want. A play, a dance, a show, a poster, a model, a report, a piece of art. It's up to you. But on Friday, we're going to learn deep learning about volcanoes, and you are going to be the teachers, not me. And so they all come together on Friday, and everyone comes with something totally different. And then we all learn. It's very, very cool. And that happens every day, multiple times with various curriculum outcomes. But the kids, it's like it's like going into a Google office where all this stuff's happening in the room and everyone's working, but everyone's totally motivated. And it's remarkable. Really, it's mind-blowing to walk into a Montessori classroom.
I love Montessori. I love the whole approach in regards to development of skills, independence, the focus on creation and play and aspects of all of that kind of thing. I actually tried to send my daughter to a Montessori nursery. There isn't one that, I'll be honest, I could afford near me. There's some that you look and they have the terminology, because it's not a patented word. I was doing some research and it's not a thing that's actually trademarked. We know that for anybody who's listening, you can go into that in terms of where its roots are, the person who created it, I suppose, in terms of the ideologies and everything else. But so many people in education and globally talk about, oh, we're Montessori, we take the Montessori approach. But I think it's more of a hook to get people in rather than actually what they believe in, I think. I find it fascinating. I really do. I think I've seen it in action. I've got a friend in Canada and she sent her children to Montessori and I loved it. I just think it's, for me, I think it's the approach. I really do.
It's funny you say that. So Maria Montessori was the first woman to graduate from university in Italy, right? She was friends with Gandhi. She was a huge observer of children. So she sat and watched children very carefully about how they learned and what inspired them to learn intrinsically, what have inspired them to learn on their own without anyone. Quite often what we do is we feel that we need to assist the child on achieving a goal. So we'll even help them to a point. But actually, when you step back and just leave them, but you've got all the materials prepared in front of them. So you say this, it's called the prepared environment, the classroom in Montessori, because you as the teacher, you've got to prepare it for the kids coming in. And what I mean is you're not preparing it for them to all have the same product at the end of your lesson. You're preparing them to be able to experiment. So you say to the kids, everything in this room is yes. Do not ask me if you can use something. Do not ask me if you can open that cupboard. Do not ask me if you can get the pencil. Do not ask me if you can move seats. Do not ask me if you can walk on the floor. Do not ask me if you need to go to the toilet. Everything is yes. These are the things that are no. You can't climb out the window and run away. You can't hit your friends. You know, there are some no's. Everything else is yes. Do not ask me. I'm busy. I'm working over here with one child. So the children, what happens is when you build that culture, they just go, well, look, I can use anything in here, you know, with freedom within limits. You know, I know that if I use all the card, then there's no card for the rest of the guys in my class. And so some children will use all the card. They will use all 50 pieces of card on the shelf. They'll cut them all up into triangles. There's no card. And when you meet, you say, well, there's no card left, guys. How do we feel? Another child says, well, I was going to use the card this afternoon, but there's none left. And the other child says, oh, my goodness, I didn't think that if I used it all, somebody else would be upset. I now know what that feels like. So tomorrow, I'm not going to use all the card. It's just like if you go into work as an adult and you start screaming at everyone in the office, no one's going to want to talk to you because you're an awful person. So, you know, that's real life. So why don't we put real life in our classrooms so that the children can learn how to be from a very early age? And I'm talking about everything, love, empathy, resilience, determination, time management, all this stuff should be sitting in our classrooms when the kids are six. So when they're 20 and they go into the office, they go, well, I know how to be a good person. I know what respect looks like. I know what responsibility is. You don't have to teach these things. You just have to let the children find their way in an environment that's pre-prepared for those things to happen.
I think it's interesting. I'm a trustee at a local preschool. So they, in the UK, we have the new early years framework is basically revolving around this child-led learning. And I love this, and I've observed it multiple times where you're going into a setting and there's lots and lots of stimuli, and the children then are, it's less guided, like from what you're saying there, because they're obviously really little children, and they are what they want to learn today, and the key workers that are around them are helping them, asking them questions based around what the children are interested in. And I really like that, and I think what you're talking about there is the next level above that. It's saying we acknowledge that there are some things that the children not just necessarily need to know about, but it'd be beneficial if they knew about these things, and therefore we'll do the exploration element beyond that. I suppose the question that comes to mind is probably a question that a lot of people who are listening to this would be thinking, well, this sounds amazing when it goes right, in terms of like they're all excited about learning about the different elements of volcanoes, or about did it wipe out all the dinosaurs and all them other elements that you were talking about. What do we do, or how does it work when children either aren't interested in a topic, or they kind of don't do that self-organized learning stuff that you're almost there's an expectation of that, isn't there?
So you can't just click, really good point, and I must have had this question a trillion times. You can't just click your fingers and everyone's independent. It doesn't work that way. You can't just say, guys, today we're going to change the entire philosophy of our entire school. It's now time for independence. Off you go, because there'll be chaos. They'll just be jumping on the tables and, you know, like one of those American movies where they're all throwing paper at the teacher and it's chaos and nuts. You have to have this kind of slow transition to independence and responsibility and confidence. And it's really important that that takes place. I think there's two things to say. The first thing is children are creatures of modeled behavior. So they watch very carefully what the people around them do, and they do that. There's no question about that. Most behaviors are learned behaviors, and this is just a fact. And, you know, I don't want to put the onus on the parents too much, but most behaviors come from their home, and this is a fact, because you've got this very simple equation. An average child will spend 140 hours at school per month, 540 at home. So they're at home most of the time. Yes, they're in bed, but they're watching like a hawk. And they watch the people around them. And there's a famous saying from Montessori, what you are, they will become. This is the fact. So the first thing to do is to model it in your school, to model this independence from your teachers, from your leaders, and your coordinators, to say, look, I am busy as the teacher. I'm busy over here. I'm working one-on-one with this child over here. I am busy. I can't hold your hand. Here are all the ways in which you can be independent. And so to kind of give the keys to the children. Yes, there'll be a tiny bit of chaos. And for any teachers listening to this out there, one of the most chaotic parts of any school week is the sport hour, when you're doing sport. And you say to the kids, all right, guys, get into groups of three. And all the kids go, oh my God, I'm going to get it. Everyone's holding each other's, I'll work with you. And they're grabbing each other. It's slightly chaotic. After 1 minute, though, it settles and it's beautiful and everyone's in groups. It's fine. And the same happens in your room. When you say you've got all the kids on the carpet and then you saw on in their chairs, your job as the teacher at the very beginning is to say the most inspirational thing ever. You've got to get those kids. You better make sure those first words that come out of your mouth when you're teaching about marine biology are the greatest, most inspirational things that have ever been said. You can't just come out with the mundane garbage that we've been spitting out for 200 years. You better get the best stuff. And you better know your learners, because you've got to make sure that they are going to be interested in what you're saying. So if you were my students now, if you were my class, and I was teaching you about whales, the evolution of whales, I wouldn't tell you about that it's a mammal. I wouldn't tell you about its migration. I would tell you something that you didn't know. I would say this, hey, and, you know, maybe we'd hold something and we'd touch something or have a model or, you know, depending on how you learn. But I would tell you that whales evolved from the ocean onto the land with dinosaurs, didn't like it, and evolved back into the sea again to become mammals and left the dinosaurs behind. An asteroid struck the Earth, killed off the dinosaurs, whales survived. That's why they're still alive today. Number one. Number two, I would tell you that trees were around before. I would tell you that sharks were here before trees. Then I would tell you, and you'd be like, that's not true. I don't believe you. You didn't. That's not happening. And I'll say, go and find out. The answers are in this room. And every kid would go, boom, straight away, trying to find, oh my goodness, sharks before trees, that can't be right. That can't be true. And so you've got to be this kind of, you've got to have the knowledge. You've got to have the inspiration. You've got to do your due diligence as a teacher. And it's really interesting to be that teacher because you love what you're talking about. And then the kids are like, this guy, like, look how enthusiastic he is. Like, I'm also feeling empowered. I want to know the answer to that question. And off you go, guys. And click your fingers. They're gone. The kids are gone. They don't want to talk to you anymore. They want to go. I could give them a worksheet, but they'd be bored out of their brain. You know, I could do that, but that's not going to work. I want to let them research this themselves and find the answers and demonstrate it in their own way.
I've got so many different things in my head. I want to know about the whales coming off onto land and then going back in. That's the first thing that I'm going to go away and do. I need to research that. But what I find the link between this, how clear this will have evolved and moved up and escalated with the digital age, and rather than the creation and bringing in the things, it's actually about research and the development and how simply and how actually it evolves and moves forward over time. But I think we had Sagata Mitra on in regards to the theories that he's introduced and everything else that comes with it. I think there's so much overlap between the soul theory, Montessori, everything that goes into it around exploration, the development and peer learning, support, getting them in groups. They can't solve a problem technically on their own and getting them together. So is that something, yes, you want to be independent and you want to drive them to do it on their own, but also surely there's an overlap of group dynamics and bringing them together rather than just this independent child?
So it's a really good point. So I would say this to you, that the words like bringing them together or getting them into groups, we don't need to do that, actually, do we? Because you put 30 kids in a room and say you can work where you want and with whom you wish. Then what happens is your independent learner, and this is where you prepare your environment correctly. Predominantly in our schools around the world, we have desks facing the front. They're all in rows. They're separated in pairs, ding, 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 and they all face the front, and it's teacher-centered. And the teacher, and on the platform and on the website, it says child-centered learning and independence and confidence. Yay! And you go in the classroom and everyone's sitting in rows and looking at the front. And so straight away, you've got a problem on your hands immediately, because some children don't learn like that. You know, some of the people who are adults, they don't want to sit next to another person and work. If I had to sit next to a person all day here and work, it's not going to work for me, that really isn't. So as a teacher and as a school and as a philosophy and a culture, you need to make sure that you've got a place where everyone is going to feel that they want to work. So there might be one table facing the wall, right? And it's an independent table with one seat and one chair. Now, it might look like punishment to face the wall, but if you've got a child with sensory processing disorder who's independent and an isolated learner and wants to work like that, and you say, work wherever you feel most comfortable, and then you watch, your sensory processing disorder child who wants to work on their own is an isolated learner will go and sit at that table, face the wall, and they will work like you've never seen them work before. Similarly, you've got your group leader who's a big cooperator and likes to communicate and talk and lead the herd. He'll be getting his group of unconfident children together, got nowhere to go, herd them in like a shepherd and say, all right, guys, we're going to build a model of a volcano. You get the paper, you get the paint, you get the papier-mâché, let's get going, and he'll lead a group. And so you've got to set up your classroom so that all those people have got a place to learn. There's no question about that. And having that knowledge of how your learners learn is really important. Number two, when you say off you go, you let them go and you watch. And what you will see in your room when you observe, you'll see skills. You'll see leadership, empathy, compassion. You'll see negotiation. So you'll see these two kids working on a paired table, and maybe I borrow your pencil, Steve, and you don't like that. And you're upset. Get off my pencil. You're very protective about your stuff. And so we start having an argument. And what we do normally in class, and I've been guilty of this myself, is I'll say, hey, boys, you're getting too loud. Separate. You move over there. You move over there. What I should actually be doing is letting it play out. And so these kids will start raising their voice and getting upset and getting angry. And then Ben turns up and says, hey, by the way, guys, you're very loud. You're shouting. What's going on here? And he becomes a negotiator. He becomes the mediator. And then we have this wonderful compromise taking place, because that's what the real world is like. If I was working an office once again, and I start causing some issues, someone's going to step in, have a word, say it's not appropriate. And so let's set our classrooms up so that children can experience that rather than trying to fix everything ourselves.
This is fascinating. And it's fascinating thinking about actually let things work out, because as teachers, and all three of us were in the classroom not too long ago, the natural reaction for most of us is like command and control, isn't it? And that's not necessarily because we're dictatorial or because we think we know everything. It's actually because we've got a curriculum to cover, we've got exams and tests to work towards. We almost feel like in order to be able to, the things that we can control, the things that we can measure, the things that we can make sure that, no, they're not going to do that, I will make sure that, direct it and I will instruct it, that actually makes us feel a little bit more comfortable. This level of freedom, which does mirror the way that people work and the way that a lot of organizations would work, is a little bit alien, isn't it? And I think what I find interesting is that the command and control instruction, you do this, you do this, you do this, is synonymous with that that factory mentality that somebody would be working in a factory, and they would do a task, they would be very instructed, this is what you do, this is how you do it, and they have a processing line, a manufacturing line or whatever else. Whereas the modern workplace is not very much like that. It's more like what you're talking about there, isn't it? But it almost feels a little bit alien from a teaching perspective.
Yeah, and let me tell you, it's a lot harder to stand at the front controlling a class for 7 hours than walking in the class and everyone's working and going, well, I'm actually just going to work with little Tommy here because he needs some help on his fractions with different denominators, and I don't need to worry about the other 29 kids because look around the room, everyone's working. Everyone's independent. And I've got a really interesting kind of segue to say something that for any teachers out there, and I've done hundreds of conferences, you know, keynote speeches, and I've had this conversation lots and lots, like, how do I actually make this happen in my classroom? Like, I love what you're saying because everyone loves this, but how can I pull it off? Well, there's two things. The first thing is the culture of our schools needs to change, because what happens is the principal comes walking down the corridor, and if there's noise and if there's movement, then that classroom is a failing classroom because the teacher does not have control of their kids, right? So that needs to change first of all, because communication and movement are the two things where, you know, how we all learn. This is a fact. Look at this podcast. You know, there'll be thousands of people listening to this. What are they doing? They're listening to it and they're feeling like, wow, this is great. They're communicating with each other. We're having a conversation here. So it's got to be part of it. But number two, it's hard to just click your fingers and have this in every classroom in the world, but there's a really good way that you can do it. And so you build into your weekly timetable this thing that I call the educational void. And it's 1 hour per week or however long you want where there is nothing in the curriculum, nothing in the timetable. It's just a void. It's an empty space. You give the kids the freedom to choose what happens in that hour, the freedom, complete freedom. There's only one rule. It has to be linked to one of the lessons we previously had, right? And everything in the classroom is a yes. Don't ask me. Do not ask me a question. I'm busy. I don't want to talk to you. So you have to plan for this void. So Ben and Dan, it's Thursday morning and the void is in the afternoon from 1 till 2. You're sitting at a table together and partners, and the teacher says, guys, it's Thursday. You've got 10 minutes to plan. What are you going to do in your educational void? You know, whatever you want to call it. So you sit down and Dan says, hey, by the way, Ben, remember the lesson we had on volcanoes this week when we were taught about Mount Vesuvius and how it, you know, it erupted and buried the whole of Pompeii? Do you want to build a volcano today out of papier-mâché in the void? And then we can show the rest of the class what it looked like. And Ben's like, my God, that's a really good idea. I'll meet you on the circle table. You bring the paper. I'll bring the paint. Write it in your diary. They write it in. You're planning for the afternoon. What do we need? You know, and in the afternoon comes, the teacher clicks her fingers. Guys, off you go. And it happens. It happens in the room. You'll see the kids who are struggling. You'll see the kids who are lost their way. But you'll also see the other kids who take them under their wing and say, hey, if you've got no one to work with, why don't you come work with me and Ben? We're building a volcano. You go, oh, my God, look at that empathy over there. I didn't realize that Steve had so much empathy because I never had a chance to see that because my kids were always sitting in rows listening to me. I never had a chance to see that core skill that he's got. And so you can slowly integrate it into your room, and then you have 2 sections of the week, 3 sections. And you have, you know, you slowly bring it into the space. And after a couple of months, you literally, you know, are fired. You don't need to be there anymore as a teacher because the kids are all like, hey, give me the curriculum. I'll plan my own day. Get out of the way. I know what I'm doing. And so not to that extent, but, you know, you almost want to get there. You know, the true success of a teacher is when they're no longer required anymore. That's just a fact.
Yeah, I love that. And especially at the moment, I mean, we were talking in the podcast a couple of weeks ago about somebody who was on the podcast who decided to homeschool their child, and their criticism really of was that the system is kind of built on pure dependence on the person at the front of the room. And if you've got a system that's based on pure dependence, then it's actually a contradiction in itself, because you've got one teacher per 30, 35 students. So you're building a system on dependence, but you've only got one teacher per 30. So it's a contradiction in terms, really. And I just wonder, because I'm thinking, and I like literally for the first, I can't believe we're half an hour in. I feel like we've just got started getting going, and I've just been sat here researching while you've been talking and looking at different books, because I'm like Steve, I've got two very, very young children. Ben's got a couple of older daughters. But my kids are in a playgroup at the moment, very much it's very much player led. So whatever they want to play with, that leads it. And my daughter's about to go into a nursery school where they build in a bit more structure. They have time on the carpet and kind of top and tail the day that way. And I'm just thinking, and I while you were talking as well, I did a Google map search on where Montessori schools around where I live. And, and I could find Montessori nurseries. I couldn't find any Montessori actual schools in terms of primary schools. And I guess something we could probably come back to later on in this episode is kind of what your view is on a Montessori style secondary school, and what could that look like, and does that exist? It'd be great to talk about that. But I guess, and this is a very selfish question, if your own children aren't going to a Montessori style nursery or a Montessori style primary school, just because, like you said before, 99.9% of schools are kind of the traditional way of doing things. I suppose as a parent, how can you almost supplement it? What can we do at home? I guess what could we do to kind of still allow our children to have that freedom, have that independence, when they go to school for 8 hours of the day, they're in an environment where it's quite the opposite.
Okay, I didn't come.
Sorry, you might not be able to answer that. I don't know. I'm just.
No. It's
curious.
Good,
really,
very good question. And I didn't come on the podcast to talk about this, but actually, I've written a book called "The Potential in Every Child," and it's exactly answers your question. So it's a Montessori-based book. As a principal for 5 years, sitting in my office, I had parents coming in all the time. Gavin, what do I do with this? Similar question to what you just said, right? My daughter's this, my son's that. What do I do? So I thought, after 5 years of doing that, I thought, well, I've given all this advice away, hundreds and hundreds of tidbits and snippets about what parents can do at home. Why don't I just write a book about this? So I wrote a book. It's called The Potential in Every Child. You can buy it on Amazon. It's all over the world.
I've just got it up, yeah. Only 13 left, so it must be selling, Gavin.
It was a bestseller in the UAE last week, actually. Number one in the... Anyway, it doesn't matter about that. But what I was going to say to you was, in this book, there are 200 ways in which you can do things at home to change the way that you think about education with your child. So I'll give you a couple, which is really, really cool. Some really cool ones. And there's many in there. But here's a couple which will, as parents yourselves and the parents listening, you do this, then you see something very different. So you go to a barbecue and the kids come with you and all the families are there. Maybe you don't have barbecues. It's always raining in England, but in Australia we have barbecues a lot. Anyway, but you go to a barbecue or a party or something like that. All the kids go in one area and all the parents go to the other area. Parents are talking about the World Cup or Big Brother or whatever else they talk about, literature, whatever you talk about as parents, and the kids go and play. Quite often, we don't look at what the kids are doing. We look that they're safe. We don't observe them. So what you do is this, and I don't want to ruin your barbecues or parties, but anytime you have a chance to do this and your kids are playing in a group of children where they are not aware that you are watching, You need to watch. You need to observe them in their natural state. And what you need to do as a parent is be very reflective of what you see in front of you. Is your child good at sharing? Are they actually good at sharing? Are they really timid when it comes to going up to somebody new? How do they work in a group scenario? When something goes wrong, do they get really upset and sit in the corner and sulk and start crying, looking for attention for someone to come and care for them? What do they actually do? And not in a critical way, but in an honest way. Many parents go, my child, no, he's a dream. He's a genius. He's gifted and talented or whatever. But the reality is that we're all different. And if we don't observe our children, you actually don't know what they're going through and what ways we can help them. So if you see that they find it really hard to compromise when someone wants to borrow their toy, if you see them, no, it's my toy, I'm not going to share it with you, you know exactly what you need to model, not what you need to teach, because you can't teach that stuff, what you need to model. So as dad, Dan, you go, well, my son's really bad at sharing. So what I'm going to do in front of him and very obviously is share. I'm going to share. Right? I'm not going to tell him to share because we say, share your things. Come on, share. Be a good boy. We don't want to do that because that's not going to teach our kids anything. You know, it's not going to teach them. They need to feel how good it feels to share. So you sit at the table and your wife, Dan, goes, hey, Dan, can I have some of those your Yorkshire puddings? Now, you don't want to give your Yorkshire puddings away because they're so delicious, right? We all know how good they are. But you say, darling, I'd be so happy to share my Yorkshire puddings with you. I absolutely love you. And you cut your Yorkshire pudding in half and you hand it over. And mum says, your wife says, oh, Dan, thank you so much. You're such a kind person. You said, no problem. You know, that's how much I love you. And you don't say anything to the child. But the child is astute, watching you like a hawk, and goes, oh, my God, my dad, he shared. And look how good mum felt when he shared. So then, boom, your child will start sharing, no question about it. And you might think that it's not true. It is true. We've done this many times in our schools. I'll give you a perfect example. We wanted all of the children in our school to read for pleasure, right, for half an hour. So instead of telling them we're going to read for pleasure in this time, all we did is we said you can do whatever you want between 12 and 12:30. But every single teacher in our school, assistant, cook, chef, everybody sat in the classroom with a book and read for pleasure. 1 week later, the entire school between 12 and 12:30 was reading for pleasure. Because every kid goes, hang on, my teacher's sitting in the library reading for pleasure. There must be a good thing to do. I'm also going to do the same thing. And so we just need to model the behavior we wish to view in the children around us. We can't teach these things. We can't tell them to be confident, but we can show them how good it feels to overcome a hurdle. So anyway, I don't want to go on too much about it, but that's just one thing. That's page one of the book. And when you know that, like you can see you're all smiling, you're like, I'm going to do that, actually. I'm going to do that because it takes a bit of effort. But you want your child to be, you want them to be the best person they can be, right? You can't teach them to be confident. You can't say, now we're all confident, yay. But you can show them that when your chips are down and something's really hard for you and you're struggling, that you overcome it and you do it in front of them. And they go, look at dad. Like he overcame that hurdle and look how he feels now. I'm going to do the same thing. I'm not going to give up. And so it's the onus is on us as the adults to model that behavior.
When is it too late to do that though? Because
I'm not giving up my Yorkshire pudding. So I'm sorry, I'm going to break off. But I'll demonstrate not giving up, but I'm not giving up a Yorkshire pudding.
I think like I've got an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old. My kids are a little bit older than Dan and Steve's. And when do we stop mimicking behavior? Because I think to myself, I don't know. Have we done the research on that? Do we know when people stop mimicking?
So we know something. We know that everybody in this meeting, everyone in this room, you learn 70% of everything you'll ever learn by the time you're 7. 70% of everything. And that's not to do with facts, right? That's not facts. That's to do with human behavior, reading body language, how to interact, looking at eye contact, all those things, how to deal with stress. You learn that 70% by 7. So you've got this window. Montessori called it the sensitive periods, and it was 0 to 7, where it's so crucial to allow your child to see what it feels like to be. That's why we have all this trauma that sits around forever. You know, as a child, I was bullied when I was really young, and it's never really gone away because it was in my sensitive periods. I experienced that when I was very young and never really went away. And so it's very important. 0 to 7, they're watching you like a hawk. They're watching everyone like a hawk. So you've got to be what you want them to be.
Is there something there between conscious and unconscious? Because I'm just thinking, like, I'm just thinking I consciously do that now. Like, I'm thinking when I'm at work, and if, let's say I'm in a meeting, and there's somebody in a meeting who comes out with something really, or they engage the people in a room in a certain way, and I notice actually they've done that really well. They've managed, they've got everyone in the palm of the hand with what they're saying here. I almost semi-consciously make a note, mental note of that, and I'm like, I'm gonna try something like that. I'm gonna try and be like that person in that way to try and get a similar result. So is there something around, is it subconscious below seven, and can you teach? Well, I suppose the answer is yes, but can you direct the child post seven, I guess, if we want to put that as a boundary, to have the habit of doing that consciously?
So post seven, what you need to remember is that pre seven, it's unconscious. So they're not looking for any feedback. There's no, it's almost like Gandhi, you know, if happiness is when you help someone who can never repay you, right? But post seven, you need their feedback. So if you want to, so for example, then you've got your two children who are 8 and 12, they need to feel what it feels like to do the good. So if they're going to plant a seed and that's their thing they're going to do, they need to go see the oak tree that grows from that. If they're going to donate something, they need to see where it's gone. You know, so they need to have the kickback, as it were, because you need that, you know, that interaction. It's like most people would rather give a donation to a lady sitting outside a supermarket with a hat, because she smiles at you when you give it and you walk away going, I did a good thing. That's post seven, because you need that kickback. Pre seven, you know, you're not looking for that. You're just modeling what you see around you. You're mimicking that behavior. So it can be done, of course, when we do this in school. And that's why it's important that we shake up the school system, because what happens is, and this is a really good analogy, is we don't give our students the feedback of the work that they've done and the impact it has on the world. So, for example, I'd say this for 100% of the schools in the world, not 100%, but, you know, a very large majority, we teach persuasive writing. So we teach the children how to write a letter, right? And you'll all smile when I say this because you've all done it, and I did it too. So you go through this whole process in your school where you learn about syntax, sentence structure, personifications, emotive language, all this stuff, and your teacher says, guys, it's very exciting this week in week number 10. You've got all the skills. We're going to write a letter. And the kids go, oh, my God, we're going to write a real letter. This is going to be cool. And the teacher says, yep, we're going to write to the school principal about changing the school uniform, making playtime longer, or putting chocolate in the canteen. And the kids write this letter. It goes to the principal. He never reads it. The teacher gives us a tick, says, great letter, puts it on the shelf, and there's no chocolate in the canteen. No uniforms have changed. And there's, you know, nothing's happened with the playtime. So the kids did all that work and nothing occurred. There's no kickback. All we need to do as schools is say, we're going to write a letter. Choose something that matters to you in society. Here are the 17 SDGs from the United Nations. Choose one. Now we're going to write to somebody, doesn't matter how big they are, how powerful they are, who can change that. Maybe it's the education minister. Maybe it's the prime minister. Maybe it's the CEO of, you know, I don't know, biggest telecommunications company in the UK. And they write a real letter and they put it in a real envelope with a real stamp and they really post it. And then potentially that person really replies or turns up at your school. And we just make it real very quickly. And that's the kickback our kids need. They don't need to put it on the shelf. What good is a piece of work with a tick doing sitting on a shelf? No good. Zero. There's no feedback for a child. The child needs to feel that the work that they have done is going to change the world in some way, little or big.
Is there an argument there to be said, if we've got that age of seven, that of almost delaying formal schooling until then, and actually focusing more on that emotional side of learning?
No. Before, why would you do that? Seven? I mean, if you think about why kids go to preschool as soon as possible, it's because there's 30 other teachers sitting in the room to learn from. You know, you put them in school so that they can see what it's like to have an argument. Like two kids are arguing over there, or they're not sharing, and they just watch all the time. They've got 30 teachers sitting in the room to learn from. They're not adults, they're kids.
Yeah, yes, I didn't mean formal as in not take them to school, but almost like a different, I didn't word that very well, but I mean like almost like a different type of schooling until the age of seven.
Most preschools are working in the same way we've talked. You've all talked about your children in preschool. It sounds like they're pretty much on the money in terms of what they're doing. And when you get to kindergarten or reception, it's almost happening as a hybrid there anyway. There's freedom, there's choice, there's play-based learning, there's independence, all built into those ones. It's not sit around and look at me. Kids can't sustain that level of concentration for 7 hours a day. So I would say that in the early years, it's already happening in most places. I think it's when we get into times for tests, for the SATs and the NAPLANs and the state tests, standardized tests, it's like, all right, guys, you need all these facts so that I look good as a teacher and the school looks good in the rankings and the country looks good in the PISA scale. All right, sit down, shut up, listen to me, read this textbook and pass this test. And that's a failure.
I suppose that comes on to what I mentioned before as well then. So what do you see as the scope for this type of learning into kind of late primary, into secondary school ages, and maybe even beyond?
There are lots of variations around the world of people pulling off this kind of learning. And, you know, like you said before, Montessori is not patented. She didn't patent it for a reason, because she wanted it to be free after she died for everyone to access, which is amazing. She could have made a lot of money out of it, but she wasn't about money, which is very, very cool. But I think there are some amazing examples of that happening around the world. One of the best I've seen is in Adelaide, actually, in Australia. It's called the Hills Montessori. Check this out. Kids go into year seven from year six. So they graduate from primary and go to high school. On entering year seven, they apply for a job in the school. And the jobs are jobs that run the school. So you're like head of horticulture. You manage the garden, right? And that garden, there's vegetables that are grown, and those vegetables feed the kids at lunchtime. There's also the trees, because the trees attract the birds that the kids study when they're doing their work on vertebrates and invertebrates. So you're head of horticulture, and in your job description is the curriculum, or part of the curriculum. You apply for that job, you get the job for one term, and then in that term, you have a certain set of time in the curriculum each week to go and do your job, knowing full well that while you're doing your job, you're ticking off the curriculum, number one, you're learning life skills, number two, but you're also running the school. And if you don't do your job correctly, the school will not run. There's like head of kitchen, head of canteen, head of stationery, all this cool stuff, but it's real world, real life, and just finding that cross-curricular link between what's happening in the real world and what's happening in our classroom, I think, is really important. And we can do that. We just need to be given the freedom by our institutions to say, I trust you, you're a teacher, you're a professional, you make the link, I believe that you can do it.
I like that. And I think most people would suggest that this kind of approach is great in a primary school, but then they actually really need to learn some real stuff and do it and do it so that they can pass an exam, and then they can. Well, any person who's been listening to one, maybe half of a podcast that we've done, we rail against that linear, has to be terminal exams, always about endpoint. We've got to do something very, very different because it's just not fit for purpose. Young people are leaving school with exam grades, but they're not fit to live in society, or not being able to contribute, not being able to work effectively. The unemployment rate, we get all that issue. It's great that we get good, that the grades go up, but what are grades in the grand scheme of things? So I think it's really refreshing to hear that. I think it'd be remiss of us now not to talk about how that philosophy and that idea of teaching and being a principal and being educating all around the world, and having a look at some of your bio stuff, like done some stuff in Nepal and like all these amazing things that are going on. And you've then founded Upschool, haven't you? And I wonder if you could just see how has that segued into the projects and stuff that you're working on now?
Okay, cool. Thank you. Yeah. So look, I was school principal for 5 years in a school, and I left at the beginning of this year, 2022. Me and a group of our friends, myself, Jake Davies and Richard Mills, who are dear friends of mine and also teachers, we had a concept, an idea. And the idea was to bring everything we've talked about just now, but bring it to the entire world and let everyone access it for free. So we developed a website called upschool.co. And what we did was we put together a series of courses. Now, these courses are totally free. There's a couple of things which is really cool, which I should definitely share with you. I think you'll definitely like these things. So we wanted to make sure, and we call it purposeful learning. We wanted to make sure that everything that we learn has a purpose behind it, has a real application to the world, and the children get that feeling. So the first thing that we did is I'm an author, so I write children's books. I've written this parenting book, but I've also written lots and lots of children's books. And if any of you are Liverpool fans, I actually wrote Kenny Dalglish's life story a couple of years ago called King Kenny, which is pretty cool. It's a rhyming couplets book. The first page is, grab a cup of tea and a piece of quiche while I tell you a story about Kenny Dalglish. Anyway, it goes like that. It's really cool. But I wrote all these children's books. And one of the things that happens in most schools around the world is kids write stories, right? So they write a story. And probably, once every 2 weeks, a teacher says, we're going to write a story, guys. Kids write a story. They color in a picture. They might make a book, a little paper book, and take it home to mum and dad. But majority of the time, it goes on the shelf with a tick. And that really annoys me, that over years, like, sitting on the shelf with a tick, come on. Like, if you put your heart and soul into a book and it's sitting on the shelf with a tick, like, you've totally failed. It is not good enough as far as I'm concerned. So one of the first courses we wrote was called Write a Book to Change the World. And we had all these connections all over the world from the charity work we've been doing over the years. So we made a charity partners with Jane Goodall Institute, which is very cool, United Nations, so they rescue girls in Uganda, John Fawcett Foundation, they restore children's eyesight in Indonesia, and blah, 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 all these charity partners. There's 12 of them on our platform. So the idea is kids come along and they start writing a book. And I scaffold the whole thing pre-recorded. I show them how to write their own children's book, from the manuscript, personifications, adjectives, how to design your front cover, how to illustrate the entire book. And we use Canva. We're very lucky that Canva, I don't know if you know Canva, but Canva give every single child who comes to our platform a free Canva account, so which is very cool. So you have all these kids all over the world, in Libya, Afghanistan, Philippines, USA, in the UK, writing their own book and then illustrating it on Canva for free, which is very cool. And they do this whole work. When they get to the end of that 10-week course, what happens is they click publish. And we built this thing called the Up School Library, and we have hundreds and hundreds of books from around the world written by children. There's two things. The book has to have a moral purpose. So the kids have to pick something big in the world and write a book about that. Kindness, love, empathy, whatever it's going to be, talking about some of those big skills. But when they click publish, a pop-up appears. It says to the kids, hey, little Tommy, you're about to publish your book. When somebody buys a copy of it, where do you want some of the profits to go? Here are 12 charities. So a little boy in Calcutta wrote a book called Heaven Restored. And he's a little boy, single mom, living in a tiny house in the most polluted city on the planet, Calcutta in India. Published a book, Heaven Restored. It sold so many copies. And he chose the John Fawcett Foundation in Indonesia, Restoring Children's Eyesight. I met him on Zoom. He's 14. And I said, hey, by the way, his name's Divyam Malpani. He doesn't mind me saying his name. And I said, by the way, you've sold lots of copies of your book. And did you know that there were 12 children who were blind a month ago, and now they can see because you wrote that book? And he started crying. And I started crying, and we all crying. And he said, I want to go because I want to write another book. He wanted to leave the meeting to go start his other book immediately, because he got that feeling. He's like, I know how good it feels to do good. And it's not as if we dodge the curriculum. Everything is in the curriculum. Personifications, adjectives, writing, sentence structure, paragraphs, all that stuff's there. Knowing your audience, it's all there. There's one added bonus. It's got purpose, and it's real world purpose. And so we like to think that Upschool, we're the bridge between the child and the difference that needs to be made. And so we allow them to make that difference. And so we've got this one course, which is phenomenal, Write a Book to Change the World. So many kids are doing it all over the world. It's just mind-blowing. And all of your listeners, it's totally free. You don't have to pay a penny. You just click, register, boom, all your kids come on board, even your homeschooling parents. And we have a couple of other courses which are really, really good. One which I should mention to you is we flew to the North Pole in August, and we recorded all of our lessons in front of polar bears, glaciers. In fact, there's one lesson which I'm talking about biomes and habitats. And this lamp behind me, there's a polar bear literally where the lamp is, 700 kilos. I'm on a little boat. And I'm like, this week we're going to learn about apex predators, everybody. And look over my shoulder, there's this huge polar bear. And the reason we did that is because lot of children in the world are being taught about climate change and save the ice caps. How many kids have ever seen an ice cap? Have you ever seen an ice cap? It's very hard to see an ice cap. But if your teacher is standing next to one or a polar bear, then it's more tangible for you as the child. It's not ideal. I mean, I'd rather have the kids on the ice cap themselves. But we want to try to make it real and purposeful for the children. We've got, you know, we've got 150 countries already on the platform. And it's remarkable, the work that we're seeing happen around the world. And it made me want, I quit my job to take this on, to try to make this happen. And, you know, we've been working like Trojan horses, all three of us, like working so hard to get this off the ground. And it's finally taking taking hold. We've got all, it's just amazing to see this work. So I could go on and on and tell you a thousand stories, but I mean, there's millions. We had a school in Delhi. They planted an entire forest. This school, where we would like to see a bird in our community. They took on the course, one of our courses. They planted an entire forest. I asked one of the girls, when will your forest be a success? And she said, when the first bird arrives, we've succeeded. And, you know, there's no grade, no point, no score, no percentage, no ranking. But a forest has been planted and a bird is going to come. And you can't buy that kind of empowerment.
That's cool. Me and Dan were both religious studies teachers before in our former lives. And so this idea around the development of empathy and the conversations around ethics and about treatment of different people and all that kind of stuff, I think is really powerful. This idea of purpose, education with purpose. We had a few months ago, we had Sir Tim Brighouse and Professor Mick Waters on the podcast who were very much talking about this idea about purpose in education. Jim Knight was talking about it from a sustainability perspective as well. And I think there's something that's missing when you can't make a connection as a child to the reason why you're having to do what you're doing. And I think that what we're talking about there is being able to ground something and make that connection into something that matters. And that story of that young man who wrote that book, who had done all the formal learning things, like you said, but then had been able to make a difference. There's something really powerful in that, because it makes you realize that your work is meaningful and that your learning is meaningful, because it's not just about you. And then imagine what would happen then in terms of understandings about climate change and about treatment of others, and what would happen in terms of conflicts and conflict resolution, all that kind of stuff. It's not hippie stuff. That's like real living and surviving and thriving in a community of difference. And I think that's super cool. That
when you know how good it feels to do good, that's all you want to do as a child. That's just a fact. You know, quite often we get to 70 and we're like, oh, my God, I haven't done anything with my life. I'm going to Goa. I'm off to Goa. I'm going to sit in a shrine. I'm going to find myself, la, 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 la. That's all good and well. It's better to find yourself when you're six, you know, to know how good it feels to feel good. And so all we got to do is add that one little strand to the curriculum, which is not why am I teaching you this, you know, but what are you going to do? What are you going to do with what you've just learned to make the world tiny bit better? Now, it doesn't have to be planting a forest. It could be planting one strawberry seed in the garden for the purpose that you're going to grow one strawberry and then give it to a kindergarten child so they can taste the strawberry. Right? That's it. It doesn't matter. That's still enough. When the child tastes the strawberry and goes, it's delicious, as the child, you're like, I did something. I did something and something changed. And that's at UpSchool. What we've done is we brought that to the forefront. And so the reason that schools all around the world are coming on board is for two reasons. Number one, the kids love the work. There's no question about it. Like, it's engaging. But number two, as a teacher, when you go to university, your lecturer tells you, now you're graduating, you get out into that school system and you change the world. You sit in front of those kindergarten kids and you change the world. And you go into school and the principal says, there's your curriculum documents. Say those words to those kids, tick those books, show me the books, then we're all good. And you sell your soul as a teacher. It's not what you come into this profession for. And so we've given the keys to the students, but also the keys to the teachers to say, you can do your work now. Now it's time to do big work, as we call it in Montessori. Like, big work is when you change the world through the work the children do. And hopefully, and we've got, you know, so many courses coming out over the next 3 or 4 months. It's going a bit out of control, which is amazing. It's going spreading to all these countries, which we love and we're very excited. So, yeah, I mean, thanks for mentioning it. I appreciate you bringing it up in the podcast.
No, I'm definitely going to be checking it out. And, we're up to the hour now, but I think there's so much there that I want to kind of pick over.
Were you going to say we could talk all night, Dan? Is that what you're going to say?
I wasn't going to steal Steve's thunder, but it'd be great to get you back on in the future and to just follow up on that, really, because there's so many strands there that we could talk about for a long time. And Gavin, I know you said before you weren't on to talk about your book, but I think people listening to this are going to want to check it out. Could you just remind us of the name of it and where they
it's
can get it
from?
It's
called The Potential in Every Child. It's a Montessori-based book about how parents can slightly change the way that they look at education in the household to better prepare their students for school. You know, it's very simple in the way it's written. I've not written it with lots of big, hard terminology, and it's like, oh my goodness, I have to sit down and really digest this. I made it very simple and digestible. It's basically 100 pages of 100 tips of what you can do. It's beautifully illustrated as well. It's really gorgeous. I'm very proud of it. So, if you want, your listeners want to grab a copy.
No big words. That's perfect for me. I checked it out on Amazon while you were talking, and I saw some. I think there's a picture of one of the illustrations. It does looks very engaging. I think it'll be good. I think I'll be ordering it before final 13 go.
I would be very hypocritical to make it not engaging after what I've just been talking about.
And upschool.co, if people want to check that out. And I think people are going to be. Gavin, it's the start of your day. We're going to let you crack on with it, and we're going to get to bed, I think. So yeah. It's been great having you on. Real eye-opener, and it was one of those episodes where every second I was writing notes, researching, and fully engaged. So thank you for that.
No, it's my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on, actually. And don't forget, Steve, Yorkshire puddings are not just for you. You've got to share them around.
Yes, what I'll do is I always have three, so I'll make sure I have five, and then my wife can have some. It's not a problem. It's not a problem. Perfect. Appreciate it, mate.
Thanks, Gavin.
If you want to stay on after the outro music, we'll say goodbye. Cheers.